Fine, Ryan thought for what seemed the 100th time. But then they're Klingons. There was no sense saying that to Weaver. He'd simply launch into a long-winded rebuttal that wouldn't take the discussion anywhere. And Weaver would be right. Fools or geniuses, you only had to understand what they were doing, not why. The what might not make sense, but if you knew it, you also knew what had to be stopped. "Well, let's see if they understand this," Ryan said. "Scott, tell the PRC that if they attack into Russia, America will come to Russia's aid, as required by the North Atlantic Treaty, and..."
"The NATO Treaty doesn't actually say that," Adler warned.
"I say it does, Scott, and more to the point, I told the Russians it does. If the Chinese realize we're not kidding, will it make a difference?"
"Well, that opens up a huge can of worms, Jack," Adler warned.
"We have thousands of Americans in China. Thousands. Businessmen, tourists, a lot of people."
"Dr. Weaver, how will the Chinese treat foreign nationals in time of war?"
"I would not want to be there to find out. The Chinese can be fine hosts, but in time of war, if, for example, they think you're a spy or something, it could get very difficult. And the way they treat their own citizens, well, we've seen that on TV, haven't we?"
"Scott, we also tell them that we hold their government leaders personally responsible for the safety and well-being of American citizens in their country."
"I mean that, Scott.
If I have to, I'll sign the orders to track them down and bury their asses. Remind them of Tehran and our old friend Daryai. That Zhang guy met him once, according to the former Indian Prime Minister, and I had him taken all the way out," Ryan announced coldly. "Zhang would do well to consider that."
"They will not respond well to such threats," Weaver warned.
"It's just as easy to say we have a lot of their citizens here and..."
"We can't do that, and they know it," Ryan shot back.
"Mr. President, I just told you, our concept of laws is alien to them.
That sort of threat is one they will understand, and they will take it seriously. The question, then, is how valuable they regard the lives of their own citizens."
"And that is?"
"Less than we do," Weaver answered.
Ryan considered that.
"Scott, make sure they know what the Ryan Doctrine means," he ordered. "If necessary, I will put a smart bomb through their bedroom windows, even if it takes us 10 years to find them.
The DCM will make that clear.
We can also alert our citizens to get the next bird out."
"Yeah, I'd want to get the hell out of Dodge City," Robbie Jackson observed.
"And you can get that warning out over CNN.
Depending on how they respond to our note. It's 8:30 in the morning over there. Scott, that note has to be in their hands before lunch."
Sextate nodded.
"Right.
General Moore, we have warning orders cut to the forces we can deploy?"
"Yes, sir. We can have Air Force units in Siberia in less than 24 hours. 12 hours after that, they'll be ready to launch missions."
"What about bases, Mickey?" Jackson asked.
"Tons of them, from when they worried about splashing B-52s. Their northern coast is lousy with airstrips. We have our air attaché in Moscow sitting down with their people right now," General Moore said.
The colonel in question was pulling a serious all-nighter.
"The Russians, he says, are being very cooperative."
"How secure will the bases be?" the vice president asked next.
"Their main protection will be distance. The Chinese will have to reach the best part of 1,000 miles to hit them. We've tagged 10 E-3B AWACS out of Tinker Air Force Base to go over and establish continuous radar coverage, plus a lot of fighters to do bar cap. Once that's done, we'll think about what missions we'll want to fly. Mainly defensive at first, until we get firmly established."
Moore didn't have to explain to Jackson that there was more to moving an Air Force than just the aircraft. With each fighter squadron went mechanics, ordnance men, and even air traffic controllers. A fighter plane might have only one pilot, but it needed an additional 20 or more personnel to make it a functioning weapon. For more complex aircraft, the numbers just went higher.
"What about SyncPAC?" Jackson asked.
We can give their navy a serious headache. Mancuso's moving his submarines and other ships.
These images aren't all that great, Ryan observed, looking down at the radar overheads.
We'll have visuals late tomorrow, Ed Foley told him.
Okay, when we do, we'll have to show them to NATO. See what they'll do to help us out.
First Armored has orders to stand by to entrain. The German railroads are in better shape today than they were in 1990 for Desert Shield, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs informed them. We can change trains just east of Berlin. The Russian railroads have a different gauge. It's wider. That actually helps us, wider cars for our tracks to ride on. We figure we can move First Armored to the far side of the Urals in about 7 days.
Who else? Ryan asked.
Not sure, Moore answered.
The Brits will go with us. Them we can depend on, Adler told them all. And Grushevoy was talking to their prime minister. We need to talk to Downing Street to see what developed from that.
Okay, Scott, please look into that.
But first let's get that note drafted for Beijing.
Right, Sexstate agreed and headed for the door.
Jesus, I hope we can get them to see sense, Ryan said to the maps and imagery before his eyes.
Me too, Jack, the vice president agreed, but don't bet the farm on it.
What Adler had said to him on the flight from Warsaw came back to him. If only America still had ballistic missiles, deterrence would have been far easier. But Ryan had played a role in eliminating the damn things, and it seemed a very strange thing for him to regret now.
The note was generated and sent to the embassy in Beijing in less than 2 hours. The deputy chief of mission, or DCM, in the embassy was a career foreign service officer named William Kilmer. The formal note arrived as email, and he had a secretary print it up in proper form and on expensive paper, which was folded into an envelope of creamy texture for hand delivery. He called the Chinese Foreign Ministry, requesting an urgent meeting with Foreign Minister Shen Tang. This was granted with surprising alacrity, and Kilmer walked to his own automobile, a Lincoln Town Car, and drove himself to the ministry. Kilmer was in his middle 30s, a graduate of the College of William and Mary in Virginia and Georgetown University in Washington. A man on his way up, his current position was rather ahead of his years, and the only reason he'd gotten it was that Ambassador Carl Hitch had been expected to be a particularly good mentor for bringing him along from AAA ball into the bigs. This mission, delivering this note, made him think about just how junior he was. But he couldn't very well run from the job, and career-wise he was taking a big step, assuming he didn't get shot. Unlikely, but... The walk to Shen's office was a lonely one. The corridor seemed to stretch into infinity as he stepped down it in his best suit and shiny black shoes. The building and its appointments were supposed to be imposing, to show representatives of foreign countries just how impressive the People's Republic of China was. Every country did it this way, some better than others. In this case, the architect had earned his money, Kilmer thought. Finally, but sooner than he'd expected when he'd begun, he found the door and turned right to enter the secretary's anteroom. Shen's male executive assistant led the American into a more comfortable waiting room and fetched water for him. Kilmer waited for the expected 5 minutes, because you didn't just barge in to see a senior government minister of a major power. But then the high doors—they were always double doors at this level of diplomacy—opened, and he was beckoned in. Shen was wearing a Mao jacket today instead of the usual Western-style business suit, a dark blue in color. He approached his guest and extended his hand.
Mr. Kilmer, a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you for allowing this impromptu audience, Minister.
Please have a seat.
Shen waved to some chairs surrounding the usual low table. When both of them were seated, Shen asked,
What can I do for you this day?
Minister, I have a note from my government to place into your hand. With that, Kilmer pulled the envelope from his coat pocket and handed it across.
The envelope was not sealed. Shen withdrew the 2-page diplomatic message and leaned back to read it. His face didn't alter a dot before he looked up.
"This is a most unusual communication, Mr. Kilmer."
"Minister, my government is seriously concerned with recent deployments of your military.
The last note delivered from your embassy was an insulting interference in our internal affairs. Now you threaten us with war?"
"Sir, America makes no threats. We remind you that since the Russian Federation is now a signatory of the North Atlantic Treaty, any hostilities directed at Russia will compel America to honor her treaty commitments."
"And you threaten the senior members of our government if something untoward should happen to Americans in our country?"
"What do you take us for, Mr. Kilmer?" Shen asked in an even, unexcited voice. "Minister, we merely point out that, as America extends to all of our visitors the protection of our laws, we hope that the People's Republic will do the same."
"Why should we treat American citizens any differently from the way we treat our own?"
"Minister, we merely request your assurance that this will be the case."
"Why should it not be the case? Do you accuse us of plotting a war of aggression against our neighbor?"
"We take note of recent military actions by the People's Republic and request clarification."
"I see."
Shen folded the papers back up and set them on the table.
"When do you request a reply?"
"As soon as you find it convenient to do so, Minister," Kilmer answered.
"Very well. I will discuss this matter with my colleagues on the Politburo and reply to you as quickly as we can."
"I will convey that good news to Washington, Minister."
"I will not take more time from your day, sir. Thank you very much indeed for your time."
Kilmer stood and shook hands one more time. Kilmer walked through the anteroom without a glance left or right, turned left in the corridor, and headed toward the elevators. The corridor seemed just as long for this little walk, he thought, and the clicking of his heels on the tile floor seemed unusually loud. Kilmer had been an FSO long enough to know that Shen should have reacted more irately to the note. Instead, he had received it like an invitation to an informal dinner at the embassy. That meant something, but Kilmer wasn't sure what. Once in his car, he started composing his dispatch to Foggy Bottom, then quickly realized that this was something he'd better report by voice first over the stew. "How good is he, Carl?" Adler asked the ambassador.
"He's an okay kid, Scott. Photographic memory, talent I wish I had. Maybe he was promoted a little fast, but he's got the brains he needs, just a little short on field experience. I figure in another 3 years or so he'll be ready to run his own embassy and start his way up the ladder."
In a place like Lesotho, Sextate thought, which was a place to make backwater seem a compliment. Well, you had to start somewhere.
"How will Shen react?"
"Depends. If they're just maneuvering troops on routine training, they might be a little angry. If it's for real and we've caught them with their hands in the cookie jar, they'll act hurt and surprised." Hitch paused for a yawn.
"Excuse me, the real question is whether it'll make them think things over."
"Will it? You know most of them."
"I don't know," Hitch admitted uncomfortably.
"Scott, I've been there a while, sure, but I can't say that I fully understand them. They make decisions on political considerations that Americans have a hard time comprehending."
"The president calls them Klingons," Adler told the ambassador.
Hitch smiled.
"I wouldn't go that far, but there is logic in the observation."
Then Adler's intercom buzzed.
"Call from William Kilmer in Beijing on the stew, Mr. Secretary," the secretary's voice said.
"This is Scott Adler," Sextate said when he lifted the phone.
"Ambassador Hitch is here with me. You're on speaker."
"Sir, I made the delivery. Minister Shen hardly blinked. He said he'd get back to us soon, but not exactly when, after he talked it over with his Politburo colleagues. Aside from that, not much of a reaction at all. I can fax you the transcript in about half an hour. The meeting didn't last 10 minutes.
Adler looked over at Hitch, who shook his head and didn't look happy at the news.
"Bill, how was his body language?" Hitch asked.
"Like he was on Prozac, Carl. No physical reaction at all."
"Shen tends to be a little hyperactive," Hitch explained. "Sometimes he has trouble sitting still."
"Conclusions, Bill?"
"I'm worried," Kilmer replied at once. "I think we have a problem here."
"Thank you, Mr. Kilmer. Send the facts quick as you can."
Adler punched the phone button and looked at his guest.
"Oh, shit."
"Yeah. How soon will we know how they're going to react to this?"
"Tomorrow morning, I hope. We..."
"We have a source inside their government?" Hitch asked.
The blank look he got in reply was answer enough.
"Thanks, Scott," Ryan said, hanging up the phone. He was back in the Oval Office now, sitting in his personally fitted swivel chair, which was about as comfortable as any artifact could make him. It didn't help much at the moment, but he supposed it was one less thing to worry about.
"So?"
"So we wait to see if Zorga tells us anything."
"Zorga?" Professor Weaver asked.
"Dr. Weaver, we have a sensitive source of information that sometimes gives us information on what their Politburo is thinking," Ed Foley told the academic. "And that information does not leave this room."
"Understood."
Academic or not, Weaver played by the rules. "That's the name for the special stuff you've been showing me?"
"Correct."
"It's a hell of a source, whoever it is. It reads like a tape of their meetings, captures their personalities. Especially Zhang. He's the real bad actor here. He's got Premier Xu pretty well wrapped around his little finger."
"Adler's met him during the shuttle talks after the Airbus shoot down at Taipei," Ryan said.
"And?" Weaver asked.
"He knew the name and the words, but not the man."
"And he's powerful and not a terribly nice chap," the president answered. "He had a role in our conflict with Japan, and also the fracas with the UIR last year."
"Machiavelli?"
"That's pretty close. More a theoretician than a lead actor. The man behind the throne sort of guy. Not an ideologue per se, but a guy who likes to play in the real world."
"Patriot, Ed?" Ryan asked the DCI.
"We've had our shrink profile him." Foley shrugged. "Part sociopath, part political operator. A guy who enjoys the exercise of power. No known personal weaknesses. Sexually active, but a lot of their Politburo members are. Maybe it's a cultural thing, eh, Weaver?"
"Mao was like that, as we all know. The emperors used to have rather large stables of concubines."
"That's what people did before TV, I suppose," Arnie Van Damme observed.
"Actually, that's not far from the truth," Weaver agreed. "The carryover to today is cultural, and it's a fundamental form of personal power that some people like to exercise. Women's Lib hasn't made it into the PRC yet."
"I must be too Catholic," the president thought aloud. "The idea of Mao popping little girls makes my skin crawl."
"Oh, they didn't mind, Mr. President," Weaver told him.
"Some would bring their little sisters over after they got in bed with the great leader. It's a different culture, and it has different rules from ours."
"Yeah, just a little different," observed the father of two daughters, one just starting to date. "What would the fathers of those barely nubile little girls have thought? Honored to have their daughters deflowered by the great Mao Zedong?" Ryan had a minor chill from the thought and dismissed it.
"Do they care about human life at all?
What about their soldiers?"
"Mr. President, the Judeo-Christian Bible wasn't drafted in China, and efforts by missionaries to get Christianity going over there were not terribly successful. And when Mao came along, he suppressed it fairly effectively, as we saw again recently. Their view of man's place in nature is different from ours, and no, they do not value a single human life as we do. We're talking here about communists who view everything through a political lens, and that is over and above a culture in which a human life had little import. So you could say it's a very infelicitous confluence of belief systems from our point of view."
Infelicitous, Ryan thought. There's a delicate turn of phrase. We're talking about a government that killed off 20 million plus of its own people along the way, just in a few months, in pursuit of political perfection. Dr. Weaver, best guess, what's their Politburo going to say?
They will continue on the path they're on, Weaver answered quickly.
He was surprised at the reaction.
God damn it, doesn't anybody think common sense is going to break out? Ryan snarled.
He looked around the room to see people suddenly looking down at the royal blue rug.
Mr. President, they fear war less than they fear the alternatives to war, Weaver answered.
Rather courageously, Arnie Van Dam thought.
To repeat, if they don't enrich their country in oil and gold, they fear an economic collapse that will destroy their entire political order. And that, to them, is more frightening than the prospect of losing 100,000 soldiers in a war of conquest.
And I can stop it only by dropping a nuclear bomb on their capital, which will, by the way, kill a couple of million ordinary people. God damn it!
Ryan swore again.
More like 5 million, maybe as many as 10, General Moore pointed out, earning him a withering look from his commander-in-chief.
Yes, sir, that would work, but I agree the price of doing it's a little high.
Robbie?
Jack turned to his vice president in hope of hearing something encouraging.
What do you want me to say, Jack?
We can hope they realize that this is going to cost them more than they expect, but it would appear the odds are against it.
One other thing we need to do is prepare the people for this, Arnie said. Tomorrow we should alert the press, and then you'll have to go on TV and tell everybody what's happening and why.
You know, I really don't like this job very much.
Excuse me, that's rather a puerile thing to say, isn't it? Swordsman apologized.
Ain't supposed to be fun, Jack, Van Dam observed. You've played the game okay to this point, but you can't always control the other people at the card table.
The president's phone rang. Jack answered it.
Yes?
Okay. He looked up. Ed, it's for you. Foley stood and walked to take the phone.
Foley?
Okay, good, thanks.
He replaced the phone.
Weather's clearing over northeast China. We'll have some visual imagery in half an hour.
Mickey, how fast can we get aerial recon assets in place? Jackson asked.
We have to fly them in. We have things we can stage out of California, but it's a lot more efficient to fly them over in a C-17 and lift them off from a Siberian airfield. We can do that in, 36 hours from your order.
The order is given, Ryan said.
What sort of aircraft are they?
They're UAVs, sir. Unmanned aerial vehicles. Used to call them drones. They're stealthy, and they stay up a long time. We can download real-time video from them. They're fabulous for battlefield reconnaissance, the best new toys the Air Force has fielded, so far as the Army is concerned. I can get them going right now.
Do it, Ryan told him.
Assuming we have a place to land them. But we could stage them out of Elmendorf in Alaska if we have to.
Moore lifted the phone and made his call to the National Military Command Center, the NMCC, in the Pentagon.
For General Peng, things were getting busy. The operation order was topped with the ideographs Long Chun, Spring Dragon. The dragon part sounded auspicious, since, for thousands of years, the dragon had been the symbol of imperial rule and also good fortune. There was still plenty of daylight. That suited Peng, and he hoped it would suit his soldiers. Daylight made for good hunting, and made it harder for large bodies of men to hide or move unseen. And that suited his mission.
He was not without misgivings. He was a general officer with orders to fight a war, and nothing makes such a man reflective like instructions to perform the things he'd claimed the ability to do. He would have preferred more artillery and air support, but he had a good deal of the former, and probably enough of the latter. At the moment he was going over intelligence estimates and maps. He'd studied the Russian defenses on the far side of the border for years,
to the point of occasionally putting reconnaissance specialists across the river to scout out the bunkers that had faced south for 50 years. The Russians were good military engineers, and those fixed defenses would take some dealing with. But his attack plan was a simple one. Behind a massive artillery barrage, he'd put infantry across the Amur River in assault boats to deal with the Russian bunkers, simultaneously bringing up engineers to span the river with ribbon bridges in order to rush his mechanized forces across, up the hills on the far side, then farther north. He had helicopters, though not enough of the attack kind to suit his needs. He'd complained about this, but so had every other senior officer in the People's Liberation Army. The only thing about the Russian army that worried him were their Mi-24 attack helicopters. They were clumsy machines, but dangerous in their capabilities, if wisely used. His best intelligence came from reams of humint from Chinese citizens living illegally but comfortably in Russia. Shopkeepers and workers, a fair number of whom were officers or stringers for the Ministry for State Security. He would have preferred more photographs, but his country had only a single orbiting reconnaissance satellite, and the truth was that the imagery purchased from the French Spot Commercial Satellite Company was better, at 1 meter resolution, than his own country could manage. It was also easier to acquire over the Internet. And, for that, his intelligence coordinator had a blank check. They showed the nearest Russian mechanized formation over 100 kilometers away. That confirmed the human intelligence that had said only things within artillery range were garrison units assigned to the border defenses. It was interesting that the Russian high command had not surged forces forward. But they didn't have many to surge. And defending a border, with its numerous crenellations and meanders, used up manpower as a sponge used up water. And they didn't have that many troops to squander. He also possessed information that this General Colonel Bondarenko was training his troops harder than his predecessor had. But that was not much cause for concern. The Chinese had been training hard for years, and Ivan would take time to catch up. No, his only concern was distance. His army and its neighbors had a long way to go. Keeping them supplied would be a problem, because, as Napoleon said that an army marched on its stomach, so tanks and tracked vehicles floated on a sea of diesel oil. His intelligence sources gave locations for large Russian stocks, but he couldn't count on seizing them intact, desirable though that might be, and even though he had plans for helicopter assaults on every one he had charted. Peng put out his 60th cigarette of the day and looked up at his operations officer.
Yes?
The final order has arrived. Jump off at 0330 in 3 days.
Will you have everything in place by then? Peng asked.
Yes, Comrade General, with 24 hours to spare.
Good. Let's make sure that all our men are well fed. It may be a long time between meals for the next few weeks.
That order has already been given, Comrade General, the Colonel told him.
And total radio silence.
Of course, Comrade General.
Not a whisper, the sergeant said. Not even carrier waves.
The RC-135 rivet joint aircraft was the first USAF bird to deploy, flying out of Anderson Air Force Base on the island of Guam. It had refueled over the Sea of Okhotsk and entered Russian airspace over the port city of Ayan. And now, 2 hours later, was just east of Skovorodino on the Russian side of the border. The rivet joint was an extensively modified windowless version of the old Boeing 707, crammed with radio-receiving equipment and crewed with experienced ferret personnel. One of only 2 USAF crews who spoke passable Chinese.
Sergeant, what's it mean when you have a lot of soldiers in the field and no radios? The colonel in command of the mission asked.
It was a rhetorical question, of course.
Same thing it means when your 2-year-old isn't making any noise, sir. He's crayoning the wall or doing something else to get his bottom smacked.
The sergeant leaned back in the pilot-type seat, looking at the numerous visual scans tuned to known PLA frequencies. The screen was blank except for mild static.
Maybe there'd been some chatter as the PLA had moved units into place. But now there was nothing but some commercial FM traffic. Mainly music that was as alien to the American flight crew as Grand Ole Opry would have been in Beijing. Two crewmen listening to the civilian stations noted that the lyrics of the Chinese love ballads were as mindless as those of their Nashville counterparts, though the stations were leaning more heavily to patriotic songs at the moment. The same was noted at Fort Meade, Maryland. The National Security Agency had a lot of ferret satellites up and circling the globe, including two monster rhyolite types in geosynchronous orbit over the equator, and all were tuned to Chinese military and government channels. The FM radio chatter associated with military formations had trended down to zero in the last 12 hours, and to the uniformed and civilian analysts alike, that meant just one thing. A quiet army is an army planning to do something. The people at the National Reconnaissance Office had the main tasking in finishing up a special national intelligence estimate, because people tended to believe photographs more than mere words. The imagery had been computer-matched with the radar imaging satellite's take, but surprisingly to no one, the assembly areas were mostly empty now. The tanks and other tracked vehicles had lingered only long enough to get reorganized after the train trip, and had moved out north, judging by the ruts they'd left in the mainly dirt roads of the region. They'd taken the time to spread their camouflage nets over the redeployed tanks, but that too had been a pro forma waste of time, because they could as little hide the track marks of hundreds of such vehicles as they could hide a mountain range. And scarcely any such effort had been taken with the hundreds of supply trucks, which, they saw, were still moving in tight little convoys, at about 30 kilometers per hour, heading for assembly areas just a few clicks south of where the shooters were. The imagery was printed up on 6 of the big laser printers custom-made for the NRO, and driven to the White House, where people were mainly sitting around in the Oval Office pulling a presidential all-nighter, which was rather more special than those done by the deliveryman, an Army Sergeant E-5 in this case. The civilian analyst who'd come with him stayed inside while the NCO walked back out to the government Ford sedan, having left behind a Newport 100mm cigarette for the president. "Jack, you're bad," Jackson observed, bumming a smoke off that innocent young boy. "Stick it, Robbie," POTUS replied with a grin. The smoke made him cough, but it helped him stay awake as much as the premium coffee did. "You handle the stress your way, I'll handle it my way." "Okay, what do we have here?" the president asked the senior analyst. "Sir, this is as many armored vehicles in one area as I've ever seen in China, plus all their equipment. They're going north, and soon. In less than 3 days, I'd say." "What about air?" Jackson asked. "Right here, sir." The analyst's finger traced over one of the photos. "Dedicated fighter base at Jinshi is a good example. Here's a squadron of Russian-made Su-27s, plus a whole regiment of J-7s. The Sukhoi's a pretty good fighter plane, similar in mission and capabilities to an early F-15. The 7's a day fighter knockoff of the old MiG-21, modified for ground attack as well as mixing up in the furball. You can count 68 aircraft. Probably at least 4 were in the air when the satellite went overhead. Note the fueling trucks right on the ramp. And this aircraft has ground crew tinkering with it. We estimate that this base was stood down for 5 days. "Getting everything ready?" Jackson asked. "That's how people did it." "Yes, sir." "You will also note missile noses peeking out under the wings of all these aircraft. They appear to be loaded for combat." "White ones on the rails," Robbie observed. "They're planning to go do some work." "Unless our note gets them to calm down," Ryan said, with a minor degree of hope in his voice. A very minor note, the others in the room thought. The president got one last puff off the purloined Newport and stubbed it out. "Might it help for me to make a direct personal call to Premier Xu?" "Honest answer?" It was Professor Weaver, rather the worse for wear at 4 in the Washington morning.
The other sort isn't much use to me at the moment, Ryan replied, not quite testily. It will look good in the papers and maybe the history books, but it is unlikely to affect their decision-making process. It's worth a try, Ed Foley said in disagreement. What do we have to lose? Wait until 8, Jack, Van Dam thought. We don't want him to think we've been up all night. It'll inflate his sense of self-worth. Ryan turned to look at the windows on his south wall. The drapes hadn't been closed, and anyone passing by could have noted that the lights had been on all night. But strangely, he didn't know if the Secret Service ever turned them off at night. When do we start moving forces? Jack asked next.
The air attaché will call from Moscow when his talks have been concluded. Ought to be any time.
The president grunted.
Longer night than ours. He's younger than we are, Mickey Moore observed, just a colonel.
If this goes, what are our plans like? Van Dam asked.
Hyperwar, Moore answered. The world doesn't know the new weapons we've been developing. It'll make Desert Storm look like slow motion.
Chapter 48 Opening Guns. While others were pulling all-nighters, Gennady Yosifovich Bondarenko was forgetting what sleep was supposed to have been. His teleprinter was running hot with dispatches from Moscow, reading that occupied his time, and not always to his profit. Russia had still not learned to leave people alone when they were doing their jobs, and as a result, his senior communications officer cringed when he came in with new flash traffic.
Look, the general said to his intelligence officer, what I need is information on what equipment they have, where they are, and how they are postured to move north on us. Their politics and objectives are not as important to me as where they are right now.
I expect to have hard information from Moscow momentarily. It will be American satellite coverage and...
God damn it! I remember when we had our own fucking satellites. What about aerial reconnaissance?
The proper aircraft are on their way to us now. We'll have them flying by tomorrow noon, but do we dare send them over Chinese territory? Colonel Tolkunov asked.
Do we dare not to? Sink Far East demanded in reply. General, the G2 said, the concern is that we would be giving the Chinese a political excuse for the attack.
Who said that?
Stavka.
Bondarenko's head dropped over the map table. He took a breath and closed his eyes for 3 blissful seconds. But all that achieved was to make him wish for an hour. No, just 30 minutes of sleep. That's all, he thought. Just 30 minutes.
A political excuse, the general observed. You know, Vladimir Konstantinovich, once upon a time the Germans were sending high-flying reconnaissance aircraft deep into western Russia, scouting us out prior to their invasion. There was a special squadron of fighters able to reach their altitude, and their regimental commander asked for permission to intercept them. He was relieved of his command on the spot. I suppose he was lucky that he wasn't shot. He ended up a major ace and a hero of the Soviet Union before some German fighter got him. You see, Stalin was afraid of provoking Hitler, too.
Comrade Colonel, heads turned. It was a young sergeant with an armful of large-format photographs.
Here, quickly.
The sergeant laid them on the table, obscuring the topographical maps that had occupied the previous 4 hours. The quality wasn't good. The imagery had been transmitted over a fax machine instead of a proper photographic printer. But it was good enough for their purposes. There were even inserts, small white boxes with legends typed in English, to tell the ignorant what was in the pretty little pictures. The intelligence officer was the first to make sense of it all. Here they come, the colonel breathed. He checked the coordinates and the time indicated in the lower right corner of the top photo.
That's a complete tank division. And it's right... He turned back to the printed map.
Right here, just as we expected.
Their marshalling point is Harbin.
Well, it had to be.
All their rail lines converge there. Their first objective will be Belogorsk.
and right up the valley from there, Bondarenko agreed. Through this pass, then northwest. One didn't need to be a Nobel laureate to predict a line of advance. The terrain was the prime objective condition to which all ambitions and plans had to bend. Bondarenko could read the mind of the enemy commander well enough, because any trained soldier would see the contour lines on the map and analyze them the same way. Flat was better than sloped. Clear was better than wooded. Dry was better than wet. There was a lot of sloped terrain on the border, but it smoothed out, and there were too many valleys inviting speedy advance. With enough troops, he could have made every one of those valleys a death trap. But if he'd had enough troops, the Chinese wouldn't be lined up on his border. They'd be sitting in their own prepared defenses, fearing him. But that was not the shape of the current world for Commander-in-Chief Far East. The 265th Motor Rifle was 100 kilometers back from the border. The troops were undergoing frantic gunnery training now, because that would generate the most rapid return for investment. The battalion and regimental officers were in their command posts running map table exercises, because Bondarenko needed them thinking, not shooting. He had sergeants for that. The good news for Bondarenko was that his soldiers enjoyed shooting live rounds, and their skill levels were improving rapidly. The bad news was that for every trained tank crew he had, the Chinese had over 20.
"What an ambush we could lay, if we only had the men," Tolkunov breathed. "When I was in America watching them train, I heard a good if-only joke. If only your aunt had balls, then she'd be your uncle, Vladimir Konstantinovich."
"Quite so, Comrade General." They both turned back to the maps and the photos.
"So they know what we're doing," Chan Kun observed. "This is not a good development."
"You can know what a robber will do, but if he has a pistol and you don't, what difference does it make?" Zhang Hansan asked in return.
"Comrade Marshal?"
"One cannot hide so large a movement of troops," Marshal Luo said blandly. "Tactical surprise is always hard to achieve. But we do have strategic surprise."
"That is true," Tan Deshi told the Politburo. "The Russians have alerted some of their divisions for movement, but they are all in the west, and days away, and all will approach down this rail line, and our air force can close it, can't you, Luo?"
"Easily," the defense minister agreed.
"And what of the Americans?" Fang Gan asked.
"In that note we just got, they have told us that they regard the Russians as allies. How many times have people underestimated the Americans, Zhang?"
"Including yourself," he added.
"There are objective conditions which apply even to the Americans, for all their magic," Luo assured the assembly.
"And in 3 years we will be selling them oil and gold," Zhang assured them all in turn.
"The Americans have no political memory. They always adapt to the changing shape of the world. In 1949 they drafted the NATO Treaty, which included their bitter enemies in Germany. Look at what they did with Japan after dropping atomic bombs on them. The only thing we should consider, though few Americans will be deployed, and they will have to take their chances along with everyone else, perhaps we should avoid inflicting too many casualties. We would also do well to treat prisoners and captured civilians gently. The world does have sensibilities we must regard somewhat, I suppose."
"Comrades," Fang said, summoning up his courage for one last display of his inner feelings, "we still have the chance to stop this from happening, as Marshal Luo told us some days ago.